Welcome to Mystical Dispute, the limited Magic the Gathering debate podcast. I'm Garrett Gardner, a.k.a. G-Guards.
And I'm Carl Chase, a.k.a. 2DuckCubed.
Check out our monthly bonus mini-episodes on patreon.com/mysticaldispute. And thank you, thank you, thank you to our patrons. And today, we are going to discuss early 17 lands data impressions for March of the Machine.
I'm ready to go, Garrett. This set so far has been a blast.
Oh, yeah.
It is very, very clearly different than Phyrexia All Will Be One. It is no longer that they're all one. Now they're marching in their machines. I clearly understand the story.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
How that works.
We know that you're a big force of those.
There's a lot of Phyrexians in both, and now they're just other places, not just Phyrexia, I think, I guess. Who knows? Doesn't matter. This has been your Vorthos Minute from Mystical Dispute.
And I've been enjoying this set a lot, and I don't think I'm the only one. I've seen a lot of positive feedback about this format, about the new battle card type. And so I think I'm going to spare everybody my beginning of the format ramp, because usually I think my problem is with the negativity, and there just really hasn't been that much negativity this time around. There's been a lot of positivity, and that's great. That's awesome. Let's do that for every set, because I promise all the sets are fun. Maybe this one will be better than average, but come on. They're all fun, right?
They're all fun, but some are funner.
Yeah, all right. Fair enough. I can concede to that.
And I will say, it sure does seem, I'm basically re-quoting a thread on Twitter, but it's worth bringing up again. It sure seems like they are extra super duper fun when Dave Humphreys is involved.
Yes.
That man has done amazing things for our community. So shout out to Dave Humphreys for another awesome set.
And Carl, you were showing me your nerdy little spreadsheets with a shared screen just before we started recording. So I think we should dive into those. In our next section called
Data Crunch.
I don't know if I'm going to use the stock thing anymore. I think I'm just going to do it. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to you. I'm sorry to everyone who listens. It's just going to be how it's going to happen. Have to happen from now on. And plus, you know, you're the data guy, so I've got to really hype you here. So,
well, thank you for the MIDI noises to hype me. Garrett, I've talked a bunch of times before about my preferred way to learn a new set from a limited perspective these days, and I think I'm fairly unique in this front. It is really to go full immersion between gameplay and data, gameplay, the data, in trying to learn the format. I find that it helps me learn way faster than one or the other. And I know there are a lot of people out there, they like to have a chance to play before they even look at the data at all.
Oh yeah, hi. I'm reporting in here as that guy.
Yeah, you and I think most people, I think I'm the nerd, I'm the weirdo here, and that's fine. But this is the kind of thing that I do for a living. It's the kind of thing I do it for a living because I enjoy it. And then now all of a sudden there's this angle with which you can have the data analytics while playing the Magic and pair the two together. And it's great. And one of the cool things about both Magic and 17 lands growing is that we get data insights really pretty freaking quick these days.
Yeah. Yeah. You compare the sample size a couple days into even a format from, I don't know, mid last year or even late last year. It's a lot more users, I think, on 17 lands, just bringing in, shoveling in that good data for Carl to, you know, refine into wonderful sparkly diamonds for us.
I don't know about that, but it is being shoveled in my direction, and I will continue to shovel it in your direction as well, with minor refinement. The most played common so far, which happens to be Preening Champion, has 32,000 games played. That is a bunch.
Yeah.
So while the format will evolve and people will learn how to play the cards better, a good chunk of the results that you're seeing in the data right now are mostly going to be what holds throughout the rest of the format. One of the things that I really like to do early on, it's not just look at the color pair data, but it's to take a weighted average of the game in hand win rate that you see from the card rating data, right? right? So, and I think we talked about this last time, but if you're listening to this for the first time, if Preening Champion has 32,000 games at a 62.5% game in hand win rate, and then Afara's Dispersal has maybe a few less games, 26,000 games, so 20% less, at a 61.3% game in hand win rate, you can wait a little bit higher on the Preening Champion versus the Afara's Dismissal, just based on the total number of games played. And if there's a card that's been played very little, for example, so I'm gonna go something crazy, right? Negate has only 1,200 games played at a 50.7% game in hand win rate. Yes, that's gonna work into the average of this weighted average, but it's not gonna matter all that much because it's 1/30th the amount that the Preening Champion's been played. So if you pull it all together and you look at the weighted averages, and let's even just start for the commons in total, it can tell you a lot about the strength of the color pairs. And so far, what we see is a pretty clear
power ranking.
Yes. And I saw a thread from Lucas Faley on Twitter where he had this exact power rating, and I almost 100% positive he was not doing this based on data. So that was all intuition. Go check out that thread. It's a great thread. But it is blue, number one, black, number two, green, number three, white, number four, and red, number five. There is a total of about a 3.3% difference between blue and red. So this is not one of those sets where there is a huge, huge disparity between right. The best color and the worst color. I mean, blue's coming in at 57.6% is the best. Red is 54.3% at the worst. And then there's like a 1 point to half a point gap between each of the colors as you go down.
And, you know, I was going to stop you there, Carl, because I know you're not saying this, but I want to make it 100% clear. When we talk about power level, right, we're talking about on average. We're not talking about like blue's definitely the best color, always draft blue or anything like that. It is so important, I think, to recognize that it is on average. And every format has this sort of imbalance. Like the commons and blue just are on average. If you put it in an average deck with an average skill level drafter, player, or whatever, they'll win slightly more. But that doesn't mean that you should always be playing in this order. You should not have this preference order because there's going to be things that are found, synergies, there's going to be corners, and there's going to be a lot to be found while we explore this format. But it's a really good baseline to know going in. You know, if you look at all these top performing commons, like, yeah, a lot of them are blue. Preening Champion, Afara's Dispersal, Eyes of Gitaxias, like a lot of them are just blue. So knowing that can give you an early edge, but it doesn't mean blue is like, quote, the best color. I don't know. I don't like to call it the best color. So I just wanted that to be said that way.
And personally, I'm 9 drafts in, so not a ton so far, at least for a lot of the volumes that I
for
usually
you,
tend to play.
For you, maybe. But sure, yeah, okay.
But I've drafted red in 5 of them, and I'm doing well with red so far. So it's, of course, all about what's going to be open in your draft. And the cool thing about not having some massive, massive disparity in power between the different colors is everything's playable, and you can play it what seems to be a fairly open strategy. Certainly, it seems to me like blue is the deepest, just by far the deepest color.
Sure,
but everything is playable, and there are good commons in everything, there are good uncommons in everything, and there are definitely strong rares and mythics in every color, and a lot of gold cards too that can encourage you to go with a certain color pairing or splash for a different color as well.
Well, while we're on the topic of blue being an overperformer, that was one of the things I wanted to talk about this early 17 lands performance data is Preening Champion is that 3-mana 2/2 flying. It makes a 1/1. Like, that card looks good, and it turns out is extremely good. But coming in number 2 is Afara's Dispersal, which is kind of like a unsummon where you can surveil 2, but it costs a full 3 unless the creature is attacking, right? And that card, to me, I had a discussion in my Discord where people convinced me, you know, it's very powerful in the context of this format. And it's really good data to know that it is performing at 61.3% game in hand win rate. That's really high for a common this early. And, you know, you can bounce the Phyrexian tokens, the Incubate tokens, you can bounce things that got backup counters on them. And in general, it seems like it's important to get some kind of cheap interactive spell in this format with all the battles around, probably, right? But that being said, like, I push back against looking at maybe the top 5 or 10 commons and being like, these are just, without a doubt, the best commons in the format. Because first of all, many of them are blue. And blue is just overperforming right now. And that will probably even out as the format matures. But also, something like Afar's Dispersal overperforming, like, I tend to have seen in the past that cheap interactive spells, they generally overperform early because they work really well when people don't really know what's going on and they might have clunkier or slower decks that are less focused. And if you can just like cheaply interact with that, you can get ahead on a tempo and you can win. And so I guess when I see something like this, it's like really good data that Dispersal is doing so well. It's obviously going to be a format defining card, but I don't view it as like necessarily one of the top best, definitely take it over all these other commons. Another card in this list that makes me think this is Saiba Cryptomancer, which is the 2-mana 0/1 that can give another creature +1/+1 and hexproof. Obviously the card is performing well, but something like that, something like coming in and giving something hexproof, people will eventually learn to play around a card like that. Once the people have the instant speed effects in the back of their mind, I could see that game in hand win rate for a card like that going down. So anyway, all that summed up, I'm just saying it's very good to recognize that these cards are doing well, but I don't think that necessarily because they're above like some green or black removal spell or something like that, that they're better, you know, necessarily. You have to look at it contextually. One of the cards that I think back on is early in the format for Dominaria United, Take Up the Shield, which gave a creature +1/+1 indestructible and lifelink, was like a top performing common. And by the end of the format, absolutely, it was a huge role player. But I don't think that you should necessarily be taking it over all of the other commons, right? When Dominaria United was fully mature. It was just very good to know early, like, oh wow, that's a really good combat trick, but not necessarily something that you're taking over like the best removal spells necessarily.
Yeah, or another card that certainly fits that category is Blessed Defiance from Midnight Hunt. +2/+0 and lifelink, and you get a spirit if the creature dies that turn, which was certainly ended up being a major player in that format, but it's not like it's a card that you were going to go ahead and take over Search Party Captain or something like that because it doesn't stack all that well. You never really want to have three of them in your hand, for example. That would be very bad.
And to draw this point home, like the top two best performing green commons are Seed of Hope, which you mill two cards and return a permanent to your hand and gain a life, and Arachnoid Adaptation, which is 1 mana for +2/+2 and reach until end of turn and untap it. Obviously, they're performing well in green, right? But I don't think that necessarily they're better than Overground Pest, which is the 3-mana 2/2. You look at five cards and you can put a land or double face card into your hand. Like, I don't think necessarily they're better than that card just because they're performing better early, but it is really good to know, like, these cards, they have a plan and that plan is working out. And in Arachnoid Adaptations, just as a last note here, I think combat tricks perform way better early when people don't know that they exist. But once they start to know that, it evens out more towards the middle.
And sample size is super relevant here, too. Like, the Seed of Hope and Arachnoid Adaptation have 2,800 and 5,200. That's way less than some of the top commons. So people are generally going to play those spells when they fit the deck. The Alsa, how late you're going to see them on average is super low. It's 8.1 for the Adaptation and almost 9 for Seed of Hope. So you can pretty much get them whenever you want. And then again, choose to play them or not in your deck. You compare that to something like a Preening Champion at 3.9 Alsa or Deadly Derision at 2.97. And you have to take those cards right away before you've already built your deck. So it's not like you get to, oh, is this the right spell for me or not? No, you gotta take it. And then
right.
It's probably going to go in your deck. And it's not like you're deciding whether or not to play Deadly Derision. It's going in your deck. So some of these things should tend to even out over time. And another thing that you can look at too is always at least keep an eye on the improvement when drawn stat early in the format. It's going to be a good indicator of just the importance of that card to a particular deck versus just whether that card happens to be in already strong decks. Or if it's got both good game of hand win rate and improvement when drawn, then it's probably both. The improvement when drawn is also going to be biased towards cards that do better in control decks or cards that do better in the long game. So you got to be a little bit careful. But like a good example here is going to be Deadly Derision is a plus 6.3 improvement when drawn, which is huge for a common.
Yeah.
Compare that to something like Meeting of the Minds, which is the 4-mana draw 2 Convoke, which is only a 0.2 improvement when drawn, despite having a pretty good game in hand win rate. So the Meeting of the Minds is a solid card that goes in a lot of good decks. Deadly Derision makes the deck actively better. That's what those stats are essentially telling you.
Yeah, that makes sense to me, Carl.
Another really interesting finding in the data so far, and I keep going back and forth between data and data.
I know, I think I've ruined you, Carl, and I'm proud of it.
You've polluted my mind on that.
I can't even remember which one I say. I think I say data, right? Yeah.
Yeah, you say data. I think I do this, though. If I'm around someone that says one of the words you can say multiple ways a different way, then I will like start getting compliated. Is that how you say it? Compliated? Completed?
I have no idea.
Towards that particular pronunciation.
So you're saying I'm a Phyrexian Praetorian or whatever?
On the data versus data distinction.
That.
Yes, you're a Praetor. Praetor?
Let's not get into that.
I don't know how to pronounce any of these damn words.
Usually in a podcast with two co-hosts, one of them is good at grammar and pronunciation and the other one isn't, but unfortunately I think we both rolled bad at that stuff, both of us.
Yeah, we suck. We're terrible. Don't come to us for storyline. Don't come to us for pronunciation of words or really anything all that useful. We're shoveling the data in your general direction. In a lot of sets, there is a clear jump up in the win rate from common to uncommon to rare and to usually rare to mythic, although rares and mythics can often be fairly close. We're not really seeing that so far.
Oh, interesting.
In this set, specifically between commons and uncommons. If you take the weighted either game in hand win rate or just games played win rate for commons and uncommons, they are really close. 55.5% for commons and 56.0% so far for uncommons. That's only half a point difference between uncommons and commons, which is, I haven't gone back and done the math on a bunch of old sets, but I'm almost 100% positive that gap is significantly smaller. And I think a big part of why that is the case is overplayed battles.
I knew it, Carl. I'm taking this as a win. I warned everybody. I thought it reminded me of War of the Spark. Don't play those uncommon planeswalkers if you can't protect them and etc. These battles, they feel very similar to me, and I'm taking it as an early win, but I'm sure people are going to trounce me and prove me wrong as the format matures and they figure out how to better play the battles.
And let's talk about it, but I think what's going to happen over time is people will stop playing the worst ones and they'll start playing the better ones, and this gap is going to widen. So let's delve into the data on battles a little bit more deeply.
Sure.
First of all, if you look at just the total number of games played across the uncommons in particular, because that's where a lot of the, yes, there's the rares and the mythics, but there's the most volume is by far at uncommon. About 1 in 6 of the total uncommons played are battles right now. And the win rate for uncommons that are not battles is 56.3%, and battles is 54.7%. That's a full 1.6 points higher for the non-battle uncommons.
Yeah, I mean, that tracks with my experience, too. Like, in my experience so far, the battles, at least some of the uncommon ones, feel a bit like traps.
You see a similar, at rare, 58.8 for the non-battles and 57.2 for the battles, and then it's almost the same at Mythic right now. Pretty close. But let's dig into that then a little bit further. Okay, so why are the uncommon battles underperforming the other uncommons? Well, there seem to be a handful of highly played battles that just aren't performing that well.
Yep.
Probably the poster child for that is Invasion of Kamigawa.
And that one's the 3 and a blue for a 4 explosion battle. When it enters the battlefield, tap an artifact or creature your opponent controls and put a stun counter on it, and then it transforms into a 2/3 flying that you draw a card whenever it does combat damage to a player or battle. I've seen this card played against me a couple times, and it's just a little underwhelming each time.
We'll dive into like the mechanics on battles a little bit more deeply, but let's just touch on it a little bit here. The front side of that is 4 mana for just tap something with a stun counter, which is very, very underrate.
Yeah, it's too expensive. We usually see that sort of effect for maybe 2 mana, right?
Yep. And then the backside is a 2/3 that can draw you cards. So it's a thieving magpie of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
But even like if that, even if just the backside of that card, like if it came right into play as the backside, 4 mana 2/3 that draws you cards when you attack, it'd be good, but it wouldn't be, I'm not even sure it'd be all that good. It's a 4 mana 2/3. It'd be okay. Right. And like you could pair that to a card like the 3/4 knight that can tap something with a stun counter. That's immediately a 3/4. That's a very similar card, except you get the creature right away. You don't have to attack and make it a creature. I mean, you compare those two cards, and while I guess the upside on the Invasion of Kamigawa is technically minorly higher, it's not that much higher. It's not a knight. It's a creature that you have to like work to get. It's actually got lower stats. So you got to think about both what you're getting on the front side mostly on these battles, and then the backside's got to come through as well. And to some extent, 100% of the time you're going to get the front side, and only some percentage of the time you're going to get the backside. So the backside isn't even a full card.
And you have to dedicate resources to flipping it, which could be resources that are just bashing your opponent in the face.
So you put all of that together, and I'm not going to go read all of the specific details of the underperforming commons. I mean, you can go out there and just look at all the invasions, but some of the higher played ones, Invasion of Moog, Invasion of Ergamon, Invasion of Belenon, Merganda, New Capenna, Regatha, although I actually do kind of like Regatha. I think that's underutilized and there's a niche for it, and I'm excited about that card and I want to make it work. But anyway, that's not the point. There's a lot of underperforming battles, and so what I think is going to happen is you're going to get further into the format, people are going to realize that these are kind of so-so, they're going to start playing it less, and then the overall win rate of the uncommons battles are going to go up just because the worst ones are going to get played less. Now, you know, you compare that to, hilariously, the Invasion of Amonkhet, which is one of the random cards we got in the preview battle, which we're not going to finalize today, but we predicted something like 56% game in hand win rate. It ended up being like literally one of the best uncommons in the entire set, if not the best. So good job, us. That card's insane because the front side is really strong.
Yep.
And then the back side is absolutely insane. So the floor is low and the ceiling is high. And yeah, play that card a lot of time. It's amazing.
And Carl, we will definitely be dedicating an episode, I think, to battles. I mean, they're just awesome. I love them so far. And like you said, like a lot of them are underperforming, but I happen to think that's a good thing. But I'll get into that. We'll get into that later on in the season.
And there's this other thing too. Like I said, okay, people are going to stop playing some of the lower performing battles, but also people are going to get better at playing battles.
Yes.
It's a literal new card type.
Yep.
You know, 30 years into Magic's existence, we're all learning this together at the same time. And this is 1 week into the format. Are we even 1 week into the format?
Oh, not even yet.
Not even 1 week into the format. I think some people are just loading their decks with like 7 battles and realizing they've got no way to flip them. Some people are playing the wrong battles. Some people aren't prioritizing tempo enough to be able to flip those battles, etc., etc., etc. So we will all get better at playing the battles. We will play the worst ones less. We will play the best ones more. And that tide will rise. But right now, it means that the commons and the uncommons overall are pretty darn close.
And I think the big takeaway from this is obviously, like you said, we're going to have to learn how to appropriately play the less powerful battles. I mean, some of them are just insane and obviously insane and they're doing great. But I think over the course of this format, we're going to learn how to better play them. But I think also the game in hand win rate for all of them will lag behind the entire time because there's new players coming in. It's a skill testing mechanic. And so when we see that, when we see cards that are complex, they have a lot of decision points. You know, every decision points is one thing that you can get wrong. As we see that in the past, those cards underperform. But the best players can usually figure out ways to most effectively use them. So I think more than any other card type, we're going to see that with battles. We're going to see the best players, the grinders and stuff, explain exactly how to get the most out of even the battles that look really bad. And I'm excited for it. battles are cool.
Totally agree, Garrett. Other quick point that I will address is the rares and the mythics. There are a ton of very, very high performing rares and mythics so far. Sunfall in particular is coming in at 69.5% game of hand win rate, which is huge. You've also got some of these legends from other sets like Elish Norn Grand Cenobite, the OG Elish Norn at 69%. I mean, that card, of course, is ridiculous if you've ever resolved it.
Mm-hmm.
But then there is a ton of rares in kind of that 62 to 69% range. Nice. And I have been on record saying, course, I don't like bombs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like game invalidating bombs. Yet so far, I feel totally fine about the rares and mythics in this set, and I'm trying to put a finger on it. And I think the big thing for me is that the commons are really strong and the interaction is quite good, and there's a lot of ways to deal with some of the better rares at common, both through actual cards like Deadly Derision, as well as just game plan. I mean, you can string together some pretty powerful things across the commons and uncommons and just do some big things without having to always go to super powerful rares. So you put that together, and maybe I've just been lucky so far. I don't know. Maybe this is not everybody's experience, but they feel palatable thus far, despite having really, really strong win rates.
Yeah, Carl, I definitely agree. I was nervous about the power level on some of these insano cards, but I don't know, it feels like you can have an answer, and when you don't, like, you probably have a bomb too, so I don't know, that extra slot, the multiverse slot, adds a lot of these like really powerful things into the mix, and I'm loving that too.
You know, every now and then you Afara's Dispersal, a legendary mythic for one mana, and then you win the next turn, and that's a way to deal with it. There's tempo, there's value, there's all sorts of different things. So I'm loving it so far. While one certainly was interesting to try to figure out how to crack the code, and by figure out how to crack the code, I mean talk to Greg Hatch for hours on Discord and just copy him. But this set feels like there is a lot of unexplored nuance to the strategy, whereas one, you kind of just had to be all in on one type of strategy, aka aggression.
Well, Carl, let's talk about that last point and wrap it all up in
closing arguments.
And Carl, I totally agree with the last thing that you said, that this format feels like it's going to have a lot of different angles and ways to interact and things to learn, but it also has the advantage of having a brand new card type entirely. So I think battles are a total home run, and that is why everybody's feeling this excitement, and just the mechanics in general, like incubate and backup. They're very cool mechanics, and so I'm really excited to explore them. But I also still, maybe someday, want to argue with you about Phyrexia All Will Be One, because I know that it felt one note, but that one note was strong, man. Just because this format has a lot of different things we gotta learn doesn't mean we couldn't have a good time with the last one. But hey, maybe I'm alone on that island.
I mean, we had planned for a long time an episode where I wanted to just absolutely trash that format, and then we didn't do it, and maybe that's for the better. So we'll be positive. We'll be positive. There's a lot to look forward to here.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I totally agree. I'm excited of these new mom-related fields to discover.
Well, that about wraps it up.
So thanks for listening to Mystical Dispute. You can support the show on Patreon. I'm Garrett Gardner. You can find me at twitch.tv/gguards.
And I'm Carl Chase. You can find me on Twitter at TudaCubed.
Shout out to 17 Lands for the data, especially this week, of course. You can support them on Patreon as well. And please, please do. Until next time, pull up that Excel spreadsheet and stay chill.
Adios. Sorry, I was literally planning. Well, what the hell was your last point? I already forgot it.
Battles are cool.
Oh, yeah. I agree. Battles are cool.